Justify. Prove to be right or reasonable. Justification is at the heart of all legal and political argument. But at a time when argument itself is slave to appearances, it is time to bring back a culture of justification. Justify, a podcast on law and politics in India from the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, hosted by Orgho Sengupta.
Welcome to another episode of Justify. As India prepares to go to the polls, this season is dedicated to examining issues of law and policy that shape our nation. The touchstone of all laws and policies is the Constitution, and today's episode is about why the Constitution and constitutional values should be relevant for the youth in the upcoming polls. We are no strangers to programs on constitutional literacy, but despite this, there is an acute sense of awareness that the Constitution amongst the citizenry, especially our youth, is visible only in its absence. Voters rarely hold leaders accountable based on whether they have implemented policies that are aligned with the Constitution. Why does this happen? Let's look further.
For today's conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by two friends. Lalit Panda is a senior resident fellow at the Vidhi Center for Legal Policy, and he works on constitutional law and has a particular fondness for law and economics. Lalit, thank you very much for joining me today. I also have Swapnil Tripathi, who is a PhD candidate at Oxford University. He's researching on judicial review and locus standi in the Indian Supreme Court, where he is actually best known as a litigant in a case that bears his name and is studied by law students everywhere. Swapnil, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Orgho. I look forward to having this interesting conversation on a very important topic that is seldom discussed and debated, and look forward
to let me start with a let me thanks very much Swapnil let me start with a question that I have often been asked about the Constitution by folks from outside the legal fraternity. Could you give me one practical way in which the Constitution affects everyday life in India? Swapnil, starting with you.
I can give you a hypothetical scenario of incidents that happen in every day in our lives and how that ties down to the Constitution. So let me call it the story of a boy, Mangu, borrowing the name from your book. So Mangu is a young boy, and one day he abruptly wakes up at 6 in the morning, let's say, due to loudspeakers playing religious music at a place of worship nearby. So Mangu tries to prepare for his test, which is due later today, but cannot due to the loud music. Now, he studies at a government school, and he goes to school and is served breakfast and lunch as part of the midday meal scheme. He loves chicken and eggs, but as per the school policy, he's only served vegetarian food. In class, the teacher is discussing India's freedom struggle, and she makes a critical remark about some of our freedom fighters. Let's say Gandhiji. Someone uploads that clip on social media, and the school, particularly the teacher, gets a backlash and is subsequently suspended. Now, during recess, Mangu and his best friend Changu go to drink water from the water fountain. While Mangu enjoys that water, his friend is denied permission because he's from a backward caste. And when they protest, they are humiliated for the caste they come from. On reaching home, Changu tells his parents about the ordeal. However, his parents tell him that ignore it and focus on your studies because we don't have the resources to go and complain to court. Now, I'm sure there is nothing new about this story, and we've heard it in some shape and form everywhere. However, every development that we've spoken about in the story concerns a provision of the Constitution and a constitutional right. So, for instance, when Mangu wakes up in the morning and has to hear loud music, the question arises whether a place of worship can play music at odd hours despite it violating public order. Now, he loves to eat meat and eggs, but is only given vegetarian food. Or can the government unilaterally take that decision? When the teacher receives a backlash on the internet and is suspended, is that not a violation of her right to free speech? When his friend is denied permission to drink water, is that not a form of untouchability, a violation of his right to life and dignity? Similarly, his parents' inability to report the wrong that has been committed on their child, isn't that a violation of the free legal aid which is guaranteed by the Constitution? I think this is just one of the many examples in which the Constitution practically affects our life. In simpler words, I believe A human being needs the following essentials to have a meaningful existence, which is clean air to breathe, food to eat, water to drink, opportunity to work wherever one wants, getting paid fairly, and having a family, and choosing, which includes choosing a partner and, in fact, not choosing to have one. I think all of these decisions are governed by the Constitution in some manner. And in fact, we are able to do this podcast in the first place is because the Constitution allows us the right to free speech, where we can respectfully critique every institution in the country. Which is why I believe the Constitution is omnipresent. We might not realize how it's affecting us in every little thing we are doing in our everyday lives, but it does influence that decision, or more importantly, is important in us being able to exercise that liberty. Now, there are reasons why we might not feel that way, but that's for a subsequent thing that we feel we're not able to enforce those rights. But it's present for sure. It's affecting our lives, in my opinion, on an everyday basis for sure.
It seems like the Constitution is like the air around us, which we take for granted till it becomes bad and noxious when we know that it exists. So perhaps if we don't know that there's a Constitution, maybe that in itself is a good thing. It means that we don't feel the need to invoke it. But Lalit, turning to you, though Swapnil has made the Constitution come alive in a series of everyday incidents that many people in India would face in some way or the other, the question still arises in terms of how, if at all, the Constitution and adherence to constitutional values should matter in the way in which people cast their votes. So, of course, saying that the Constitution should matter in some sense is a platitude. Yes, of course, it should matter in the same way in which clean air should matter. But why should it specifically matter to anyone, since it sometimes appears to be of no immediate consequence to anyone? All these examples that Swapnil mentioned, yes, people may face it somewhere or the other or not, but may not be the issues that are top of mind for people. So should the adherence to the Constitution and its values matter when people are casting their votes?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting way to have put it. I think the way Swapnil has described the manner in which constitutional law infuses different aspects of life really speaks to something about the generality of constitutional principles. So how I view this situation is that constitutional law it has the potential to come up anywhere in your life. And that's why it's always there in the background. That's why we're talking about it in these terms, as if it's something in the atmosphere, as if it's something in the plumbing. It's always there at the back of our mind, at the back of what's going on in day-to-day life and politics. But that doesn't mean that the Constitution is relevant for every question of policy, every question of law. And I think the way one tries to separate these matters is by trying to determine what aspect is the question that we want to leave to ordinary politics. That is to say, politics in which a simple majority from an election would determine how governance is taking place, how the government relates with the people. On those ordinary questions, it's where one has to try and think of the Constitution not mattering. But I feel as if since we are going into this thicket of the question of why the Constitution comes up when we think about voting, that we should mark out how exceptional this question is in a way. Because every time I say the word ordinary over and over again, it's easy to forget that what we call ordinary isn't going to be the case in all situations. Politics may be about voting about specific laws that have been made by a legislature, but there can be situations where the politics is of a different order, a higher order, so to say. Constitutional politics, let's call it. So I want to just to help us navigate this conversation, I wanted to draw out this distinction between two ways of looking at the relationship between constitutions and politics. This is actually a very interesting subject because I have over the course of time heard a lot of people having different views about this. Some people have very extreme views that the constitution is something that's entirely outside of politics. Politics takes place every day, governments come and go, but constitutions are supposed to endure. Elections are not about constitutions. And then other people come from the other extreme, saying that how could you say that? At the end of the day, government has to depend on the will of the people. So, regardless of which way you go around it, the constitution itself has to emanate from the way people think about it. And I feel like when you look at it in these two pole perspectives, these two poles, you actually miss out on the actual relationship between constitutions and politics, which is that it goes both ways. And I think what I was saying about ordinary politics is the vision that we most often see about the constitution. That this is an example I often like to use. When you're playing cricket and you want to figure out how you're going to play cricket, you have rival teams. These two teams go against each other. And when they are playing, they don't midway through the game decide that I'm not going to hit the ball with the bat, or I'm going to decide to run only halfway between the through the pitch to finish taking a run, or I don't change the crease, the location of the crease midway through the game, because that makes the game unfair. And forget about unfair, that makes the game into something else altogether. And this is the way one likes to think about the constitution and politics in a way. It's often a vision that's very easy to sympathize with, that when you're playing the game of politics, you are playing according to certain rules. And those rules have been set by the people beforehand, where the boundary runs, whether you hit the bat, how you get to win the game, all of these things are set separately. And if you decide to tinker with the rules, what you're doing is you're not playing cricket anymore. You're playing a different game. And the game you are playing is figuring out which kind of cricket you enjoy. Do you enjoy
Yeah, so
T20?
I think that's actually a good point because it becomes second order. But if I were to continue that analogy, the voter in this example is essentially someone sitting in the audience who's looking at this game being played between two sides, while someone's batting and someone else is bowling. And there are, of course, set rules of the game. Now, as a watcher of cricket, I know that there are some rules in the background, but I don't really care much about them. At that point of time, I care about whether my team is winning or not. And if I don't have a team, I care about good cricket being played, which is essentially good shots being hit and good balls being bowled and people fielding very well. So why should I care about what these rules of the game are? Because the rules are there. They are there somewhere. No one is really changing them. At least even if they're changing them, they're not changing them overtly. It's unlikely that they are suddenly now in the middle of the game. You'll say now an over is only four deliveries and not six. It's unlikely that this kind of thing will happen. So, in a very real sense, as a spectator of this game of cricket, why can't I just be bothered by the two sides and who I like more? And why do I have to think about what goes on in the background?
I feel that this is something I was trying to get to, that this analogy isn't actually perfect, of course. Our life in India, our life in any nation, the way we live under government isn't a game. It's not like cricket. It's not like any sport, because in sport we have some very narrow constraints about what we want out of the sport. We know that we want to enjoy, we want to see sportsmanship, we want to see a real test of people's physical abilities as well as their fortitude, mental fortitude. The way in which they deal with the rival team. We want to see these things because they pick out certain aspects about what we like to see in that very specific situation of a physical game. And different games might also give you different feelings about what you enjoy seeing. In, say, figure skating, ice skating, you might really enjoy the aesthetic of the sport. It's not really a game in which teams are playing against each other in the same way. It's not a team game. But in government and in politics, I think the variables involved, the things you have to think about at one go, are far too many. There are too many things going on at the same time. And because there are so many things going on at the same time, we have to depart from this analogy, this simple analogy of how things work, that rules are set at one stage and the game is played at another. And this is what I was trying to get at. Which is that while it is simple to think of the constitution is something that sets the rules, and politics is something that happens on the basis of those rules. There are times in which we have to talk about that game in which the politics is being set. Sorry, the rules are being set. For example, again, going back to the cricket example, nobody thinks about a committee room in which people are sitting and deciding when we want to change ODI cricket into T20 cricket. How many overs should we go for? Should we go for 30 overs or should we go to 25 overs? Why should we stop at T20 to make it into a nice game? Nobody's thinking about sitting in that boardroom. But when that meeting happens and somebody comes up with the game after having thought about it, after having asked people, maybe after having tested the game out, people see it and they enjoy it in a particular way. I think this sort of helps parse out the difficulty of thinking about that game about rule setting. We don't care about it because we don't think about it often, but it does affect us once it's already changed.
Yeah, and I think that in the maybe this is a good point to bring Swapnil in as well, because you do hear a lot of sporting analogies when it comes to politics, particularly elections, right? You hear someone being pipped at the post. This happens quite often. You hear the word cliffhanger in some kind of electoral contest. And I think that there, perhaps, contrary to what Lalit said just now, perhaps there is an analogy here in terms of there being some rules of the game. The game here being, let's take it for the moment as an election contest. The rules of the game are set by the Representation of People Act, other laws, and the Constitution itself. The players are the various contestants for that, and the people. I mean, you can think of them either as spectators or you can think of them as umpires if you want them to have a more active role in what they're doing. Now, and I again come back to this point that do you think that when in this game, and I think this is the issue, that people will decide on the basis of what they see, not on the basis of what they don't see, and the rules are somewhere assumed as background conditions. So do you think that the Constitution ought to matter in when people are watching this game of electoral politics?
I certainly agree. I think it should matter. It doesn't at given how we vote, but I think it should matter because the Constitution is not just a document that is setting rules. Often when we talk about if I could just go back in a bit of legal history, when we talk about India attaining independence, the Constitution that we framed and the values it's laying down are significant. It's an important document, and if be it get letting go of its colonial roots, the power and power the rights creating document, its nature and the rules that it is laying down, if any government is tampering with those rules or tampering with the principles that it is laying down, it should be an electoral issue because it is not just a law that is passed by people with some debate in the parliament. It's an important document given our history, which I think doesn't feature enough, and it has a lot. It has the people at the center of the entire document as people at the center. But when it comes to voting and our everyday lives, people are in the sidelines and they don't engage with that document. Neither do they realize how much of the power it's giving. And similarly, like we were talking about the cricket example, right? We call cricket a gentleman's game because there are certain ethics, there are certain morals. And if those ethics and morals are being compromised in the first place, then the game is being compromised. And second, when it comes to when we call the people are mere spectators, I think elections give people the opportunity to be beyond spectators. And bring that change in the game itself by being involving their representatives, engaging with them, ensuring that they're upholding the values, the rules they're supposed to function under. So I think in that sense, the Constitution should matter, and the people should hold the government accountable if they feel that they are violating a particular rule or they're violating a certain principle that the Constitution is laying down.
So I think that's actually a good segue to talk about a couple of practical situations in which the Constitution has come into play recently, and perhaps hear your views on how that should matter. Now, I want to keep aside questions of where governments are violating the Constitution. Of course, I agree that it should matter very clearly if governments are doing that. But we're not looking at that kind of situation where someone is changing the rules of the game as they go along. But we are looking at situations where the Constitution has been interpreted by the Supreme Court in a certain way, and we're looking at whether and how that should matter to a first-time voter. So let's start with the recent judgment of the Supreme Court in the Article 370 case, where it held that the nullification of Article 370, that is, the special status being accorded to Jammu and Kashmir, was valid. So Jammu and Kashmir would now cease to be a state. It would become two union territories of Jammu and Kashmir and Ladakh, and that it would now they would not have any special status anymore, and it would be governed like every other state, or as of now, a union territory in India. So Swapnil, just so that our listeners understand this fully, in your view, what implications does this judgment have on our constitutional understanding of federalism?
So, first of all, I think the court has taken a position that is a relatively regressive position on federalism. So, at the outset, just to clarify, India is not a federal country how the US is. In popular discourse, especially on amongst youngsters and social media, we read Article 1 quite literally. That is, India is a union of states. However, we should read it
Now
in
you have to
context.
say, India, that is Bharat, shall be
Bharat,
a
India, that
union
is
of
Bharat,
states.
shall be a union of states. However, we should read it in context. That is, India is at best a quasi-federal country with a unitary bias. However, despite the constitution giving certain broad powers to the union, there are certain designated areas of functioning of the state. The state government has, significant autonomy over certain areas. There is a seventh schedule, there are separate lists, etc. And there are situations where the union can interfere in matters of state administration. But the threshold that the court's previous judgments had laid down and the constitution lays down is that either there should be a breakdown of constitutional machinery or there should be a national emergency, or when it affects federalism, you obtain the consent of the state that is required or you obtain their views before taking certain actions. And even when it comes to amendment of the constitution, then if it is touching upon the aspect of federalism or it's affecting the state, then the ratification requirement is also there, that two-third votes in the parliament and ratification by the state. Now, in the Jammu and Kashmir case, what has happened is the scheme of federalism has been compromised in two ways. One, the union government has been given a carte blanche power to make irreversible changes to the state that has been upheld by the court. And second, they have also been given a power in contravention, in my opinion, to the spirit of the constitution, which safeguards state interest. Well, let me elaborate on the two arguments. First, as you briefly mentioned, that there was a precedence rule declared under Article 356 when the Jammu and Kashmir bifurcation happened, when the presidential orders were issued. Now, effectively under which the president could exercise the executive powers and the parliament was given the power to exercise legislative functions. Now, the idea behind this provision is that the state machinery should continue to function and governance should be carried on while the precedent rule is being enforced. And there are numerous judgments which clearly state that when the normalcy is restored, elected governments can reverse the decision. However, in the present case, what has happened in Jammu Kashmir was that the president changed the very nature of the state and changed its existence. And this change was irreversible. And this is exactly what was challenged before the court. Now, under Article 3, the obtaining the views of the state that is being affected was a requirement, is a requirement that the Constitution states. But in Jammu Kashmir, since there was a precedent rule, the state legislature was the parliament, and then they obtained just the views of the parliament. Now, resultantly, what has happened, the status has changed permanently. And the court has completely ignored this, in my opinion, by reading the Constitution quite literally. The problem that happens going forward is if there is a reason why these provisions are there in the Constitution, because when you're carrying out a change in a state where you're carrying out certain significant, you're exercising significant powers by the union, you obtain the views of the people. That's what federalism is in, that's how it's ensuring the rights of the state. But the court over here is sidestepping that responsibility and saying that no, you can carry out, you have absolute powers to undertake any changes, even if that change is irreversible. So hypothetically, in future, it's also possible that, and this is one of the examples the court had itself given during an oral exchange. Let's say there are other states which are troubled states or which have insurgencies going on. Over there itself, parliament can exercise this absolute power and turned the state into a union territory. And the reason we have a separate parliament and a separate state legislature is important because a state legislature is supposed to deal with more immediate issues of the state, the issues of regular governance that they're dealing with. But if that power is taken away from the representatives of the state and put at the hand of a parliament under an operation of a precedence rule, I think that is a significant breach of the principle of federalism. And at the end of the day, it's an irreversible action. The existing jurisprudence and the cases cited by the court in the 370 judgment state that we are allowing absolute powers to the parliament because the elected legislature can subsequently undo them. Over here, that undoing or reversibility of that action is not possible altogether. So you're creating a significant dent on the power of the state legislature in the first place, which can potentially be misused in the future. And it is a sign of warning for the states to keep in mind because it's severely affecting our principle of federalism.
No, I think that's a very clear explanation of the impact that the Article 370 judgment has on federalism, whether someone agrees with that view or not. But I'll turn to Lalit on that. There are two ways in which we could see this issue as kind of an electoral issue. One is that it could trouble us if we were committed federalists and we believed that the state should continue to have a significant say over matters of governance in which are primarily local in nature, which have been taken away by this judgment. I mean, that is perhaps one way to look at this. The other way to look at this is perhaps there is a design flaw in the Constitution itself, and that if I were a citizen, that again, coming from that same federalist impulse, the Constitution, as the court points out, just says in Article 3 that a new state can be created provided the views of the state legislature are taken. Now, in this case, of course, those views were not taken because that provision itself was suspended during President's rule. But there could be another way of looking at this, which is that the Constitution itself is extremely, extremely centralized and that itself is a problem. So the problem is not so much the judgment of the court that now it has sanctioned an irreversible act, but a problem with the Constitution itself. At which level would you see it?
Yeah, I think to break down this problem, there are actually two or three points that one can pass out. And to help explain this, I thought it would actually be helpful if I take it back to that cricket analogy, just to break it down a little. I feel like Swapnil caught on to something that I was trying to express when I was talking about why designing the game of cricket is different from designing the constitution. Which is when he mentioned that, in fact, we are not spectators. In the game of cricket, when there is that committee that is deciding when to make what to make out of cricket, whether to make it into a T20 game, whether to make it into a T15 game, they don't deal with the spectators in the same way that people who have to make constitutional changes have to deal with people. It's fundamentally different. There is a spectator there. The committee probably cares more about the players, about revenue, about the international committee that is involved in running the game of cricket, completely different considerations. I think in the 370 question, in the context of Article 370, one can think about kind of comparing this committee that does not care about the spectators so much as it cares about the revenue or cares about itself. You can compare this with Parliament. Parliament sitting in a boardroom somewhere without a direct connection to that specific question about what people in Jammu and Kashmir want for themselves, what specific problem they were going through when they ended up with Article 370, decided to make a game out of it, which was T20. They didn't care whether the people of Jammu and Kashmir may have actually wanted something else, whether in the context of designing this game that actually mattered. So I want to just
Maybe just to interrupt you for a second, that they didn't care about the spectators in the stadium as much as they cared about the TV viewing spectators.
they
That
cared about a certain audience.
might
Yeah.
be an analogy.
Yes, but then what is the basis on which we decide which audience to care about? That's where we're kind of getting stuck with trying to make this metaphor work. So I'm going to abandon it at this stage. But I want to just like draw out this distinction between what happens when ordinary politics is at play, which is we look at the constitution to enforce things about that ordinary politics, when things are going well, when politics is proceeding fairly, let's say, we look at the constitution as something separate from it. We look at it, we need to look at it that way, in fact, because we can't have the constitution coming up for for debate in the course of that election. At least that part of the constitution that allows elections to run. For example, can you think of democracy itself as an electoral issue? That's the kind of question that, you know, people get troubled by, and they say that no, the constitution has to stand apart from politics in some way. You can't decide to elect a government on the very premise that they will destroy democracy, let's say. But the way in which constitutional politics comes in here in Article 370, is that that rule setting mechanism that's supposed to allow politics to take place, that's supposed to allow the people of Jammu and Kashmir to decide something about themselves, that is under question. What aspect of politics, what aspect of Jammu and Kashmir's union with India is up for debate and not up for debate was precisely what 370 was dealing with in a way. There was no question, for example, that we are going to stop elections in Jammu and Kashmir forever. The question was always whether certain differences in the way governance took place, despite elections, whether that should be continued. So I think when we talk about elections and the constitution as an electoral issue, there are two or three situations in which we can think of this coming up. One is when there is a failure of the courts. The courts are failing to enforce the constitution as we consider it to be the case. And many would argue that that was what happened in 370 as well. Some would say that, certainly, that the constitution as it stood currently was not interpreted the right way. For example, in giving certain amount of power to the president in determining the status of Jammu and Kashmir, some would say that that's where the failing took place. And if that's the case, if the courts are failing to enforce the constitution, it may be that there is a breakdown in some kind of, there's a particular kind of breakdown that needs to be solved by elections. Another way could be that there is a breakdown in relations between the court and the executive. Some would argue that the courts came under pressure, pressure from a government that was far too powerful to stand up to. And this is a whole different kind of constitutional crisis. But it's once again because that constitutional mechanism is failing in some way that we have to turn by necessity to the people, in a way, going back to the people to figure out something that was supposed to be figured out by the constitution. And finally, this is what the question that you put to me right now, which is that there was something fundamentally wrong with the constitution itself. My personal view is that that wasn't the case with the 370, with the case of Article 370. It was possible to work around it despite what it had. But that nonetheless remains a third example of when one has to turn to the turn to elections, which is the question of constitutional change. That there is something wrong with our constitution, and if we want to change the constitution, in the end we have to appeal to the people in some way through the election. So I
No, I
think
think you've given three very clear ways in which the constitution can be an electoral issue. And I'll take that to Swapnil, because the question still stays with me that if I am a resident of Jammu and Kashmir, of course, I would vote on the basis of this issue and what different political parties are saying they're going to do now in the aftermath of the judgment. But if I were somewhere else in India, and of course you've pointed out the possibility that this might happen to you as well, but let's keep that aside for a moment, because it's a theoretical possibility at this point of time. And if we go back to your Mangu example, I mean, Mangu is concerned that he doesn't get to eat chicken and egg, right? At the end of the day, that's what he wants. He wants to eat chicken and egg. So he is happy to vote on the basis of, which party will give me chicken and egg for lunch. But what we have here is perhaps a second order question, that the reason you don't have chicken or egg is because a particular government is deciding this. And if actually we were a truly federal country, then not A, but B government would have been deciding this. So vote for B government. Now, that's a second order way of thinking about this issue, where actually what he wants is he wants a party to come up and say that please give me chicken and egg. So on federalism, and this is the crux of the question really, why should federalism matter as an electoral issue to people?
I think federalism matters because there is a reason, like I was mentioning before, there is a reason in the first place why we decided to have separate legislatures when it comes to state and the parliament. Parliament, at the end of the day, is a body that is representing the entire country, but it's represent one member of parliament is representing a lot of people. And it's not always possible for one body sitting at the center of the country to decide what is, let's say, good for Mangu directly. So that's why we needed to be a bit more decentralized. That's why we had the concept of federalism, that we'll demarcate certain other territories for the state legislature, because they're present at that place. They can decide what to do and what not to do. It is this ability that if a court or a judgment lays down that even though that's the setup we've decided for, the people sitting in Delhi can decide what's supposed to happen in another part of the country, which might be far away, and not their own elected representatives who they've chosen. I think if that ability is being hampered, the possibility of Mangu being able to exercise or being able to hold his representatives accountable and get what it's want is being affected in the first place. Because you're not letting those elected representatives who are more accountable to me, who are living near me, who I'm voting for in elections, to decide what should and what should not be done. That's of course at a more abstract level.
No, so it seems to me it's quite clear that there is the continuing relevance of the Constitution to our lives. It's just that the distance that one has to travel is a bit far, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done by colleges, law schools, the legal fraternity in bringing the Constitution closer to the people. And that's really what we are trying to do in this show. So let's take another example, which is perhaps cuts a little bit closer to the bone for many people and is not an issue like federalism, which is sort of at least one step removed from people's lives. And that is the judgment of the Supreme Court in the marriage equality case, where they held that there is no right to marry in the Constitution, and persons belonging to the LGBTQ community cannot marry under the Special Marriage Act. The dissenting judgment said that there could be civil unions that they could enter into, but there is no such legal category, so one doesn't exactly know what that means. So, Lalit, for a person who identifies as belonging to the LGBTQ community, is there a way to make this issue an election issue, or is it primarily a judicial issue for the courts to now overturn?
Yes, so I think we've this is a the way one has to think of this is to maybe separate this example of the marriage equality case from a few other cases about rights. Because if we don't do that, we can get a little lost with a broader label of rights. What do rights involve? For example, if it was a case that was clearer, say in the instance of the Section 377 case. We're talking about Suresh Kumar Kaushal with the two-judge bench of the Supreme Court, which ruled that Article Section 377 of the IPC was valid, or the Navtej Singh Johar case, which found it invalid. That's the kind of case that one would want to put within the court of, I mean, sorry, I was using a tennis analogy, but within a task of the court to deal with. And I think it's worth asking ourselves why we think that's the case. When we think the Constitution is clear, that the rules of the Constitution are clear, and when we think that the rules of the Constitution are good, they are right, and we believe in them. Here I'm talking about the rule that says that we shouldn't discriminate against LGBT people. If we really believe in that rule, and if we see that rule clearly as having been violated, then we come to the view that it was the court's job. We all always will. We can often allow, of course, that if Parliament had gotten there first, That is to say, if they felt that their electoral demands, the demands of the of elections and of their own democratic impulses that they were facing, if those were driving them to make this decision to remove Section 377 of the IPC, then they should have done so. But we end up turning to courts because something goes wrong at that level, that elected representatives end up thinking that elections are all that matters. And that's it's because they think so, and because we move this function of rights entirely to courts, and we move this function of non-rights politics entirely to elected representatives, that we end up with this problem that courts have to deal with rights. The problem with the marriage equality judgment is that the judges themselves were not clear about where that line fell, courts versus the legislature. They felt that in terms of rights, at least the majority felt that in terms of rights, what was asked of the court when they had to create this new thing called queer marriage was that they had to ask the government to do something new. They weren't asking the government not to interfere with someone, not to invade someone's life. They were asking the government to, in fact, go into someone's life and help them. And they felt that that's not what rights are supposed to be about. And this is where it becomes tricky. Because we don't think about how to interpret the Constitution, questions of interpretation of the Constitution, as something that comes up in elections. Nobody in the elections is going to say that the text of Article 15 that says don't discriminate on the grounds of sex is a reason why you should not vote for one government or the other. They are going to say something about what people feel, about what people are going through, what their lives are like. So they don't end up talking about rights. And I recognize this as a problem. I think because the court has lobbed the ball back at the government, it's only because of this immediate cause that this has now become a political issue, that it is now on governments to do something about it. But one can as well say that the court had adequate reason to interfere, and it could have interfered in particular ways. In which case one would have not called it an electoral issue so much as a legal issue.
No, that's right. And I think that, of course, I believe that legal issues are at their heart political issues as well. The judges may provide a different kind of forum with a different kind of reasoning to come to a conclusion, but politics can reach that same conclusion as well. It's only because it doesn't do it in certain cases that we go to judges. But Swapnil, I'll come to you. So should a citizen of India, thinking about this, as Lalit said, that it could very easily be a political issue, and you can sort of try and work with legislators in order to get these issues more front and center. And I know of several organizations which try to do that with LGBT rights, try and get questions in parliament and legislatures, try and get this as a more mainstream issue. But for a citizen of India who does not identify as LGBT, let's take that as a as the kind of person we are thinking about. How does that person engage with this issue? As in, is it something that they should that they perhaps not care about at all, as one might imagine, or is there any other reason as to why they should care about an issue of this nature?
First of all, just if I could just add to the point Lalit was making, I think even when an issue is before the court, it can be treated as an election issue from the position that the government is taking before that court. If the government is opposing a position before a court that no, we don't want something to happen, then it's making its position fairly clear that where it stands on it, and that can be taken into account. And wherever the courts have stepped into matters of policy, be it Vishakha or be it other cases, that's only been possible because the government supported it and said, okay, we are fine with you legislating. So that is a distinction that should be kept in mind. But coming to your second question regarding why it should matter to people, I think even if you don't identify as someone who's part of the LGBTQI community, at the essence of this debate is how the government reacts or how a particular political party reacts to something that it might not principally agree with or be able to understand. It might be an interest that you might not be able to identify as, but whether you're still willing to go out and grant them certain protections, which the Constitution recognizes. And it might be considered as an issue that, oh, the numerically they might not be in the major, the community might not be in the majority at some point. But I feel in our life and society, we are always in a minority in some position or the other. But if those interests are not guarded, are only contingent on the numerical votes that we have, then I think that should be an election issue at the first place. That whether my rights are protected, even if I don't have numbers, and whether parties are willing to fight for those rights in the first place. And you can change the scenario and put it in any position, and I think that will always matter. And that's why that should be an electoral issue for anybody. It's beyond the issue of just recognizing, queer marriages. Tomorrow, I might be in a position where my rights are such that the society doesn't agree with, but is the government still fighting for recognizing my right? And second, it's also whether we as a society or a political party or a government is willing to show an ability to change and grow, or we are still stuck to just cater to a certain electorate that this is what exactly they want, so we're not going to go beyond it. And I think all of that should matter to a citizen, because you can be in that position, like I said before, at any other point of time, that whether you are being considered in the scheme of things or not, even if you're not voting for a particular government or you're not their core voter base.
If I can,
Yeah, sure, Lalit.
no, I felt like Swapnil actually struck on something that's worth expanding on a little, which is that yes, when a voter is looking at the way the government responds to a problem like this, that may not directly impact the voter who's thinking about it. Rights help in these questions, or any constitutional rule or principle actually helps in these questions, because at least if I was to put it in a very let's say, emotional sense, the way in which rights are framed, or the way in which any constitutional rule is framed, actually promotes empathy. Or if you want to use a more constitutionally regular usual term, it promotes fraternity, the way in which it is framed. The way in which the right against discrimination is framed isn't that it has separate pieces of one about sex discrimination, one about caste discrimination. And this case is very much an example of it. What this case involved, the marriage equality case, was at its heart a question about whether the government had a duty to do something that it wasn't otherwise doing so as to promote equality, do something new, step up, go ahead of what it was already determined to do. Spend some more money, spend some more, give some more attention to another group. Now, this is not a question that is limited just to queer people. And in a way, whether or not the right against discrimination stands for you as a woman or a man or a Hindu or a Muslim or a forward caste or a backward caste isn't a question that is separate from how somebody else is going to experience it. That right is going to stand or fall the same for everyone. If it fails for one person, it is also going to fail for the other. In the marriage equality case, one very simple analogy one can draw is in the context of the government being asked to do something new to create equality for queer people, and the government being asked to take up this duty of doing something new, for example, in reservations. In law, that's a question that often comes up. Does the government have a duty to provide reservations? So in that very specific legal question, this is a question that directly came up in the marriage equality case. Does Article 15, the right against discrimination, require positive duties? This is a question not just for queer people, but for anybody who thinks the government should do more for equality.
Yeah, and I think this distinction that we hold so dear, that when you're asking the government to not do something versus doing something positively, this, as many people have shown, is really superficial. Like, even when you're asking for free speech, which is you're asking for a book ban to be overturned, you are also implicitly asking for courts of law, you're asking for policemen, you're asking for a law enforcement machinery, all of which has to be set up to adjudicate on civil and political rights. So it's not perhaps that, there are certain civil and political rights which require negative actions or restraints for the government, and these kind of that there are certain other kinds of rights which require the government to take positive duties. I think there are positive duties that are intrinsic in all kinds of rights questions, and I think we should not labor this distinction too much. I agree, Lalit, with what you said right at the end, that it is about empathy, and this is what rights do. And as citizens, as it, we perhaps owe it to our fellow citizens to be empathetic, and that is why vote for rights. And even if we can't be empathetic, and if we were to be the epitome of selfishness, I remember Martin Niemöller's poem about the Nazis, and that first they came for the socialists, and then they came for the trade unionists, and then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up on any of those times, but then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. So I guess even if you are very selfish, then it does behoove you to think about the violations of rights of other people, irrespective of whether it's the government that is causing it or an interpretation of the court. So I think that's one key thing that I'm leaving, that I'm getting at the end of this conversation, that rights do matter and constitutions do matter for every citizen. So last word to both of you. The constitution has a long way to travel before it permeates into the minds of citizens. So if you had a magic wand, what are the two things that you would do to help the Constitution along to become, as we had said in a previous Vidhi report, a book in every home? So, Swapnil, what would you do to make the Constitution that?
I would want the constitution to become how we teach, how while growing up we are taught scriptures at our house. I want constitution to become a part of our dialogue every day, because I feel at the end of the day it's a document that can teach you so many things of how to be an ideal citizen. It has everything. It has how do you, what are your duties as a citizen, how you should be as a human being. You should not discriminate. You should treat everybody with dignity. Treat everyone fairly. What should you ask of your representatives? It has everything under the sun of what a good human being should do. But it is still not part of our regular discourse. What we get in the name of constitution in school is a civics class, which no student is interested in, and we are taught the constitution is the longest in the world. I don't think that's what about the constitution that we should be taught. And there are a lot of interesting ways of doing it. There are, I mean, I've come across some, and it should start from an early age. It shouldn't start once we reach law school. It should start from the early age of school. Students should be told stories about how the constitution came about, why having a constitution is a big deal for a country like India. Why is that constitution unique for us? I think once we start doing that, then people will start realizing the importance of having that document in the first place and subsequently engaging with it in the future. And for instance, if I could give you an example, we know a lot about our culture because we had books like the Amar Chitra Katha that broke it down for us in such a simple manner. Why not have something like that, or a simple way of dispense of you know the making the constitution reach our homes like that? And that
That's a great
starts.
idea, constitutional Amar Chitra Kathas, and also constitution to be taught like scriptures, but like the best of scriptures, maybe document that you can also disagree on in part and
Absolutely.
question and not take it as gospel truth. So those are two very clear ideas, Lalit.
So I was reading recently about India's history a little while back, and it really struck me because it's not something you hear more often right now. In pre-independence history, when India was still struggling for freedom, a number of people outside India, and I have in mind here some documents, for example, by I believe it was Lord Irwin, one of the viceroys in India, Aldous Huxley, a writer from another country, talking about Indians. One of the things they mention is about the fact that Indians seem to be suffering from a kind of inferiority complex. And I don't know why I haven't been able to shake off this description, because of the sense of recognition that I have that this is still something that might be in us all. When we talk about the Constitution and the way in which we as Indians are relating with our Constitution, I sometimes think about what this means. This feeling that we do not have ownership over our own nation, over our own destiny. Is this some kind of way in which we have carried on this inferiority complex from a previous era? So when I think about what it would take for people to care more about the Constitution, one of the things I think about is how one really decides to take responsibility for this thing. when you are playing a game of cricket and somebody does something wrong, or you're playing any football game or some game and somebody fouls, breaks a rule, and there is no referee anywhere to actually intervene, we still step up. We still step up to try and make the game go well. I do not get the sense that Indians generally feel that way about the way in which our government is structured. I don't know how one can make a feeling arise in people, but I do know that that's where we have to start. It has to be from that feeling that I am responsible for how this document, or if not this document, how this structure is going to fare in future. And I think something that will certainly help is if we certainly we do need to know about constitutional law. I think the law as itself in itself helps in figuring out many of these things. I feel like when we talk about how the constitution should be, how it can change, how it is wrong, these questions of the basic structure doctrine, what is essentially unchangeable about the constitution, that helps. But all of these evade some more fundamental questions that get missed not only in India but abroad as well, which is the question of design. How do you design this constitution? If you were to sit today and decide to make it out in scratch, how would you think about it? I don't think we are equipped to think in those terms precisely because we don't, everything is set up in a way that we don't have to think about it. And I think this requires a bigger shift than I'm even able to express right now.
No, I think that's a very deep thought to end this on. This also invokes some deeper philosophical thinking that real change comes from within and that we should look within when we are looking to see as to how the Constitution can become more important to everyday life in India. What I'm taking away from this is that it will become important to everyday life in India if it becomes important to my life in today's setting where I am. And I think that's a good note to leave it on. Thank you very much, Swapnil. Thanks, Lalit, for this really invigorating conversation. My thanks to both of you.
That somber note is an ideal curtain call for today's episode. Our takeaway is that for the Constitution to matter to the country in the elections, it should first matter to the individual in their everyday lives. Thank you, Swapnil and Lalit, for joining me today. As we close, cast your vote for our special audience poll, Free and Fair. Our question today, does the Constitution matter to everyday life in India? Vote yes or no. And to cast your vote, visit my Twitter account at the rate @orgho_justify. You have 48 hours to respond. Adjourned.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, follow us on Twitter at @Vidhi_India for regular updates. We are on SoundCloud and Spotify as Vidhi Center for Legal Policies Podcast. You can also listen to us on Google Podcasts or iTunes. Email us at justify@vidhilegalpolicy.in to share your comments and feedback on this episode.